Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 2018 Cairo International Film Festival, and I'm very pleased to be joined by the great filmmaker, Mr. Peter Greenaway. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So I just wanted to start off with a very simple question. Is cinema dead?
Yes, I believe it is. Do you believe that cinema can be defined by you sitting in bed or your office on a sofa looking at a little tiny screen, probably on your own, and you make comparisons with the history of cinema, where most of us regarded cinema as an event? You left your house, you walked down the street, you went into a big black box and you looked at the screen, which is bigger and noisy than you are, in company. You have to come to a film festival to more or less see that happening now. And I think, you know, that everybody has a laptop, everybody has a smartphone, everybody has a camera recorder of some sort. So we're all filmmakers. And that ubiquity in a curious way is counterproductive. We've been talking now for about 2 minutes, right? So all over this city, all over Egypt, all over Europe, all over Africa, there must have been 2 million selfies taken. But there's only 50 good photographers in the world.
Yes.
So mass does not necessarily indicate quality. You know that sort of UK newspapers, you know, some of them are full of photographs of footballers' wives and kittens up trees. Do we regard that as very important? There's a way, there's a pyramid in culture, isn't there? There's a way that hopefully we graduate to the top. So we end up historically with certain artifacts. They could be paintings, they could be plays, they could be writings. You come from Ireland, you know how rich the Irish literary tradition is, created European classics. That's what we remember. The famous Roman said that a great work of art is 50% entertainment and 50% instruction. If it's only entertainment, you've forgotten it tomorrow afternoon, and if it's only instruction, that's so boring you've walked away. So you've got to find a way to put together the instruction and the entertainment, and those are the works that survive.
I do come from Ireland. I grew up there. And the terrible thing about growing in Ireland, especially as far as cinema is concerned, is that we don't have cinemas that show good films. I don't remember, even in my childhood, seeing them there. So I guess we never had that. I feel, though, that nowadays people do get a chance to watch films. So that is one good thing.
Well, the history, I mean, the history of cinema is really, I suppose, very, very approachable now, isn't it? We probably will either see it reviewed, I suppose, on some sort of television flashback, but much more as a question of personal choice. You can pick up the DVDs very, very, or you can cheat and download them from 1,000 different places. So we now know or can access the obscure films of Claire Denis.
Yeah. Actually, this is funny you mention that, because when I found out you were here, I wanted to watch The Pillow Book again, and I couldn't find it anywhere. Couldn't find it on a BFI player.
You weren't looking hard enough.
It's somewhere. Yeah. But so this accessibility thing can be a little deceitful, because you think that everything is online, but actually there aren't things online. But where are the things that aren't online? And are we going to remember it in a few years' time? That's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, there's another curiosity, isn't there, that because cinema, apparently despite your disappointments at not finding The Pill Book, it's so ubiquitous, it's a bit like the old days. You know, the only time you read James Joyce's Ulysses when you broke your leg and ended up in a hospital bed. And it's a bit like that. You know, because cinema is so apparent and so readily available, we ignore most of it. Because we all think, we can do it tomorrow, we can do it next week, we can do it when I'm an old man, got nothing else to do. A bit like Voltaire said, I only write novels, so I have something interesting to read when I'm an old man.
You mentioned selfies earlier, and this is something that kind of came in my head there. What do you think of them?
Well, it's extreme narcissism, isn't it? Extreme narcissism. And you wonder, it's like the old, you know, the Japanese, we used to criticize and laugh at the Japanese because they were always behind a camera and you never even saw their face. And they only realized they'd been to Venice when they got back home and looked at the photographs, which always seems to be an unfortunate sort of substitute for the real thing. I refuse to take selfies, and I refuse to take photographs anymore. But I don't look at them. What's the point of taking them? I never look at them.
Interesting, because I often think that, like, there used to be a time when people would have to wait to get to the end of the film roll, and then they would have to get it developed, so getting the pictures back would be a real, real event.
Well, that used to happen to me. I used to take photographs, but I never even bothered to develop them, so I never ever saw them.
Yeah.
It's a sort of curious waste of time, I suppose.
Well, let me ask you then, why do you think people should... Is there a reason why people should take any photographs at all?
Well, it's narcissism, isn't it? It's a great delight, you know, to see yourself, apparently. You know, I have young children who are always doing it. It's become a sort of social necessity. It's a sort of, you know, give up God and start taking selfies in a curious way. But watch out, because in English, God is only dog backwards.
Is there any truth in the photographic image?
Well, it can be cheated, can't it? And a photographic image is based upon a single little tiny piece of the environment. So if you're looking at my nose and taking a photograph, what's happened to the rest of the, you know, the room? It's highly, highly selective. Maybe that's what makes it particularly attractive.
Right. Is that what makes it attractive to you? Or?
Well, it's not. I just explained. Taking selfies is not very attractive to me.
No, you taking pictures of anything filming. Actually, what is it that attracted you about the image, the reproduction?
The ability to fix it. I come from a long line of people interested in natural history. I was always worried about leaves falling off the trees, you know? What the hell is this? It's moving, it's changing. We've got to stop this, we've got to catch this. And I think, like most children, you know, most children are quite capable of drawing, and I was quite good at it, and, you know, your mother pats you on the head and said, well done, dear, etc., etc. So you're encouraged. And so I felt the one way to fix the world, to fix it, to hold it, was to draw it, and then obviously to paint it, and that became a more serious desire. So I went to art school in London, and then at art school in London, like everybody, I think, in the early 1960s, discovered cinema. Mm-hmm. So, you know, films of Ingmar Bergman, you know, are up on the rack there. And before very long, you suddenly realize there's this great French New Wave and this extraordinary Italian cinema, the, you know, that starts with Rossellini and ends up with, I don't know, Last Emperor, you name it.
Yeah, so you were a cinephile before you became a filmmaker.
I suppose so, yes. I never had any ambition until probably I was about 20, I think, about 21. I was 21 in 1963, and that's, you know, the center of the so-called swinging London, you know.
Yeah.
All that Carnaby Street, Beatles, you know, that whole phenomenon.
Good times to be alive.
Yeah.
Good times to live.
All times are good. Come on.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, do you remember an image that struck you that was like, okay, this is good.
Well, I think, let's retrace a bit. Ingmar Bergman's Seventh Seal. Have you seen that? Extraordinary film for a 15-year-old adolescent. You can see naked women. Where else can you see naked women? And it's also about religion, and it's about superstition, and it's about history. And it's extremely well made, and you know it's very cheaply made. You know, there was always this terrifying thing in the 60s that movies were so expensive, you'd never be able to make them. But you look at a Bergman film, and he made it, you know, in 7 days on a back lot somewhere in Stockholm, and you realize, yes, it is possible. It is possible. You know, sell a car and make a movie.
Essentially, it was the naked body that you wanted to...
Well, it's sex, but, you know, 15-year-olds, who's surprised? I'm surprised you asked the question.
No. I wanted to ask the question, actually, because you're a great filmmaker of the human naked human body.
The human body, you know, it's what we all have. Eros and Thanatos. I'm interested in the very beginnings and the very ends. And now I'm 76. I think I'm more interested in the end than I am in the beginnings.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm going to die soon. You know, nobody lives forever. And I think, you know, is it possible? I keep asking myself, is it possible to have a happy death? Is a happy death possible? With your Roman Catholic background, that must be a riddle for you, too.
I think about death all the time.
There you go. And, you know, how will it happen? I'm writing scripts now about deaths. I've written a script about an American journalist who goes back to his origins in Italy, which you know so well. It's set in an extraordinary city called Lucca, quite near Pisa, up in the north, and a very interesting historical city. We hope to be able to get Morgan Freeman to play this very old man who goes back looking for his roots. Mm. He's looking for his grandmother to see, in fact, if his grandmother committed an act of adultery, which results in him being born.
I think this is going to have to be my last question, but I want to ask you this, and this is personal. I was just in Milan, and I saw The Last Supper by Leonardo a few days ago for the first time in my life, and I had this physical reaction where I was shaking. I'm trying to understand why.
You know, that's called the Stendhal syndrome. You're not alone. Stendhal, great French novelist, a hell of a long time ago, went, I think, to Florence, and saw some paintings by Fra Angelica, and he fainted. He finally saw the real thing, which he'd been used to in terms of reproduction. And that's well-known sort of categorized syndrome. Mm. So you are suffered from Stendhal syndrome.
Does it ever happen to you?
Not to me particularly, but Vivian Westwood was going to do the costumes for the film I made about Rembrandt. It didn't happen. But she came to Holland. I live in Amsterdam. And I took her to see Rembrandt's The Night Watch. And she started giggling. And she couldn't stop giggling.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And that's the sort of, you know, frisson relationship. Suddenly seeing this extraordinary painting, which she knew very much. And the guard actually came up to me and said, "Would you kindly take this lady out of the room? She's disturbing the other visitors." Okay, we did. I mean, nothing ever happened, you know, it didn't work out like so many things in the cinema. But I think that was an indication of a certain sort of Stendhal syndrome.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to meet you and talk with you.
Okay, thank you.
And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.